From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas public school system is declared unconstitutional. So what happens next? One influential lawmaker says the legislature needs to get to work on the fix right now.
We sort of have a split view. There are a number of us, including myself, that believe that the judge has given us marching orders and has really just sort of restated the obvious, that our school finance system is not working. And we want to get to work on it right now.
Governor Rick Perry surfs the California airwaves looking for job generators to bring back to Texas.
Building a business is tough, but I hear building a business in California is next to impossible. This is Texas Governor Rick Perry, and I have a message for California businesses. Come check out Texas.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Texas public school system went on trial on October 22nd. Testimony lasted 3 months, and a ruling was delivered this week. A district court judge found that the tax system Texas uses to finance public schools is unconstitutional. Judge John Dietz determined the legislature has not adequately funded schools as required under the Texas Constitution. Key to that decision was the fact that in 2011, the legislature cut $5.4 billion in public education funding. The state countered that the system, while flawed, is still constitutional. But this is not the end of the fight. Attorney General Greg Abbott is expected to appeal the case to the Texas Supreme Court. Closely following the school finance saga is Joe Smith. He's a former school district superintendent and the editor of the online state education blog, TexasISD.com.
No, there was not anything in the ruling that surprised me.
You expected this because it was pretty much a slam dunk.
It was a slam dunk, but I expected that because, you know, there were several reasons that I expected it. And one was that in West Orange Cove, the court and the judge indicated that those findings were, you know, were what he found, but everything else was just on the cusp. And when the proof was laid out that funding is no better than it was in 2003, and we have 700,000 more kids, that to me was the icing on the cake that made the case.
Now, I'm seeing statistics being put out by people who are critical of this decision, saying Texas has increased our funding for education over the years and that test scores have not changed.
I don't agree with that. I don't know about the test scores. I'm not going to comment on that. But funding has not changed. It has not increased. If you look on my website, I've got a chart of funding that the Legislative Budget Board did, and it has a graph in constant dollars where they looked at the funding level in constant dollars, taking into consideration inflation. And if you look at it, you'll see that the dollars have remained basically the same. And that is the same without taking into consideration that over that decade, there was 700,000 additional students.
And we've also had that school property tax
compression, yes.
And if you look at just how much is coming out of Austin, that may just give you the impression that the state is putting more money in, but it was supposed to be a change up in the way money was distributed.
That's right. They took money from the that was local money going in, and they changed it to Austin money going in. But if you're the school district receiving it, it was the same amount.
With this decision that we have, what does it mean? What happens now? Does this automatically mean we're going to see a change?
Absolutely not. I expect the state to appeal to the Supreme Court, and I don't expect the legislature should look at it and say, man, we've got a problem, we need to address this, and it should be an emergency item on the that they're addressing. I don't think they'll do that, and the pundits are all looking at the fact that they'll wait until the Supreme Court tells them they have to before they address it.
if we were to suddenly start working on this decision today and try and fix it, would this automatically mean that taxpayers in Texas would be paying more for education, or would that money come from someplace else?
Well, I don't think it would necessarily mean the taxpayers are paying more. I think if we don't fix it, the taxpayers are definitely going to be paying more. And those in the least wealthy school district are going to be paying the most. When we took away that property tax for the school district, the state assumed the funding structure. Quite frankly, they may have assumed too much, but I think they assumed it. And really, it's all the taxes and all the structure belongs to the legislature. And how they determine that they want to put it together in order to fund a school that meets the Constitution, you know, that's up to them.
Well, this has gone back to them before. This is not their first time a judge has told them, it's the same judge, as a matter of fact, that they need to fix the education system funding, and nothing happened, or it was just the bare minimum and still not enough. So why do we have faith that it's going to be fixed now?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I do. but my thoughts are that we have a situation where it'll get fixed when the people of the state of Texas finally decide that this is a priority and we can't tolerate this any longer. And that's when it will be fixed. And we have got to communicate the unfairness that exists from having a funding structure like this. And it's not an unfairness today that just impacts today. It's an unfairness that's going to impact everything in the future. And so, you know, we've got to address that situation. And where the money comes from, I mean, we have a very restricted tax structure, so that is going to be an issue.
I keep thinking about the kid. He's in third grade and another one's in seventh grade. I mean, they only get one shot at those grades. And
that's right.
The longer we put these off trying to find a solution that to a system that we know is broken and that needs repair, but we can kick it back to the courts, and all that does is just so that guarantees that kid's third grade or that other kid's seventh grade,
yeah,
they're not going to get the skills and the help that they need.
We need some statesmanlike leadership. We need some people that are willing to step up and say, let's do the right thing. You know, we'll go from there. If somebody doesn't vote for me because I fix this, so be it.
Joe Smith is a former school district superintendent. He's now a consultant and runs the online blog that covers Texas education issues, TexasISD.com. The school finance ruling comes as the Texas legislature is in the early stages of the session. But the conventional wisdom under the Pink Dome is do nothing. Ignore it. Don't act until you absolutely have to. But one leading Democratic representative, Trey Martinez-Fisher, is telling his fellow lawmakers to act now.
Well, you know, I think people are still just sort of absorbing the effect of the ruling, and we sort of have a split view. There are a number of us, including myself, that believe that the judge has given us marching orders and has really just sort of restated the obvious, that our school finance system is not working. And we want to get to work on it right now. And then there are other people who believe that, you know, the legislature has no control right now, and that we should wait for the litigation to finish and run its course with the Texas Supreme Court. And so I don't believe in that. And in fact, I presented a series of inquiries this morning to the Speaker of the House, asking him to clarify our own operating rules, because the Texas Constitution allows the members to establish its own order of business. And so I think that, you know, people who drafted our Texas Constitution long ago knew that there are going to be things that are going to be very important that we need to address them. I happen to believe school finance is one of them. So, and I also did some further research that suggests that we have passed legislation while controversies were tied up in courts. And the clearest example is the Fisher case, which is the higher education affirmative action case before the United States Supreme Court. We passed legislation just this last session to deal with that, and we made provisos to deal with the result of litigation. And so clearly we don't have to wait for the Supreme Court to act. We all know what the problem is. And this is one of the few sessions where we actually have some money to spend. So we should certainly, you know, get very serious about getting serious with public school education and school finance.
So some people are saying that there should be a special session called of the legislature right after this one ends in May and take it up then.
Well, you know, I that seems to be the new normal around here. I mean, but the Constitution puts us up here for 140 days. Special sessions cost money. Special sessions are diverting resources away from what we really need to be doing. I mean, I think we should take every spare nickel we have and start fixing things like public education. I'm open to the idea of working on this issue, you know, anytime, any day, but what is wrong with the next 120 days? Why can't we be doing it now? And so the Constitution clearly allows us to establish our business. Judge Dietz has made a very articulate ruling, and we have yet to even start to explore, you know, the potential fixes for school finance. And again, bear in mind, this is done at a time where we still have $2 billion in this current budget cycle that's unspent. We have $5 billion in the next budget cycle that's going to begin unaccounted for or unallocated. And we almost have, you know, close to $12 billion in the rainy day fund. This is a very rare time for us to have this type of money in Austin. We know that public education is going to require a big investment. Let's fix the problem now before we divert these resources to other things.
Governor Rick Perry, in his State of the State address and also in his remarks to the lawmakers at the beginning of the session, said he wanted to see taxes cut. Now that we've had this ruling saying that we've got to fix public schools, is there still momentum behind the Perry train of cut taxes or have tax rebates rather than fix these problems?
First, let me say, I don't believe that there is a groundswell for cutting taxes up here. I think that, you know, Governor Perry's talking about cutting taxes by $1.8 billion. There are 25 million people in the state of Texas. That means each Texan will get $36 for the next 2 years. Frankly, I'm not so sure if there's going to be a lot of, you know, love for a tax cut that's going to put $36, in my pocket. I'd rather take $1.8 billion and fix a school system. I'd rather take $1.8 billion and build some new roads. I would rather take $1.8 billion and build some water reservoirs. Let's have some meaningful use of that money for a project that the entire state will benefit from. I think when Texans realize that we're talking about a $36 tax credit, that's still a lot of money for hardworking families, but I think we all recognize that we can put that money to work and leverage it by the infinite. I mean, we can leverage that, to do something really big and really neat, you know, something that we really need in the state.
Legislation is going to have to be crafted and passed that will create some sort of mechanism to generate more revenue for schools in Texas, right?
Well, yes, I think that we always need to be mindful of finding revenue sources. But again, I mean, we find ourselves in these times where, you know, the energy production in this state has been significant. A nearly $12 billion rainy day fund, mostly funded by taxes on oil and gas. I think we need to recognize that as we continue to invest in that infrastructure, we're going to see the returns. But yes, we have a tax system that is losing money instead of making money. There are a number of people from wealthy Texans to hardworking, you know, mom and pops who have said we will pay more money if we know it goes into our public school system. I think that, yeah, as a state, we recognize what's important. Sometimes we lack the political will up here, and that's why I'm trying to force the issue now.
State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher is a Democrat from San Antonio. He's building a case in the Texas House for lawmakers to begin finding solutions now to deal with the unconstitutional school finance system. Earlier this week, Governor Rick Perry began running radio ads in California, asking businesses to move their operations and their jobs to Texas.
Building a business is tough, but I hear building a business in California is next to impossible. This is Texas Governor Rick Perry, and I have a message for California businesses. Come check out Texas. There are plenty of reasons Texas has been named the best state for doing business for 8 years running. Visit TexasWideOpenForBusiness.com. And see why our low taxes, sensible regulations, and fair legal system are just the thing to get your business moving to Texas.
Now Perry is taking that job-snatching pitch on the road. Perry announced he is taking an economic development trip to the Golden State. Perry will travel this week to San Francisco, to Silicon Valley, and to Los Angeles to meet with business leaders in high-tech, biotechnology, and the film industry. The governor's trip will be paid for by Texas One, and according to his office, no tax dollars will be used for his travel and accommodations. Californians, including Governor Jerry Brown, are sounding off about Perry's job poaching, saying the Texas economic miracle is no more than a mirage when the state is cutting education funding and is last in the nation for health insurance. Perry's radio ad and job-snatching strategy has not gone unnoticed in California, and San Francisco Chronicle columnist Joe Garofoli says it has sparked a needed conversation in California about its economic future.
This story has taken on a life of its own. It probably is one of the best investments that that Texas has ever made. For $24,000 that this private partnership, private-public partnership has made, he's gotten unbelievable amounts of media boom here in California.
Good media boom or bad media boom?
Well, I think it's definitely started a conversation here. Some of it's been good and some of it's been bad. And it's a conversation about, you know, where are California jobs going? How many are going? Why are they going to Texas? And really, what's in Texas? Why are they leaving for Texas?
So people really do feel like there is a leakage of jobs, a hemorrhaging of jobs in California to Texas.
Well, no. They don't. I think some people may feel that. This has been something that conservatives in California have been talking about for a while. They said, you know, people are leaving the California in droves. Now, independent studies have shown that there really isn't a whole heck of a lot of leakage to California. I think the Public Policy Institute of California did a study going back maybe 15, 18 years from the 90s through the 2006, and they said it's, you know, very, very little job. There's really very little job relocation, you know, from one state to another. And even there was a study that I think that showed from the Good Jobs First, it's an advocacy group in Washington. They showed that 225 companies moved into Austin between 2004 and 2011. 63 were from California. So much of the expansion is sort of not companies picking up lock, stock, and barrel moving, but it's companies, you know, expanding in Texas and doing a lot of their back shop stuff there.
Now, you really can't blame a business for going to a location that's going to best serve their bottom line. But do you think Perry is playing a dirty pool by making such a big deal about it, doing it with such flourish, and also using taxpayer dollars to offer companies to relocate?
Rick Perry's not doing anything that any other governor hasn't done. Governors do this all the time. In fact, politicians at all levels of government do that. You see cities, one city trying to get a shopping mall from or a major development from one city to another to move over to get the tenants to go from one place to another. He's not doing anything illegal here. I think what people here may be questioning is, or just scratching their heads about, is here's a guy that state's spending, you know, what, $18, $19 billion a year in incentives to corporations to expand or move to Texas. At the same time, they cut their education budget by $6 billion. I think the question here among a lot of people is, it stinks like corporate welfare. On the flip side, California could be doing more. That's another issue it's been raising. What is California doing to bring more business to this state? Now, there's all kinds of differences. The labor costs are a lot cheaper in Texas. The land is a lot cheaper. So there's economic differences there. But it's the whole thing, for $24,000. It has started a conversation that we never thought we'd have.
Some people say that Texas is kind of being a parasitic state in a way that the workforce is educated and trained in California, and then when they're ripe and ready to go, they get in their trucks and they move to Texas.
I think a lot of people call that capitalism. What they're doing is they're offering a deal, and companies are saying that what appeals to me, I would make more money taking that deal, and that's what they're doing. You know, you can call it all kinds of names, but those are the names what the states losing the jobs usually call it.
This seems to be sort of an avatar argument over the conservative red state attitudes of Texas versus the bright blue state attitudes of California.
Oh, I think that's definitely a part of the conversation. And I think a part of it also is people who live in California, particularly the folks who live on coastal California, can't understand why would anyone go to Texas? You know, that's I think, at the core of the argument. Now, if you're running a business here and it's cheaper to do business in Texas, you have that answer. But, culturally, I think people have a question like, well, why would they go there? You know, of course, you know, the people in the Bay Area always say, except for Austin.
Businesses run on people and brain power. You know,
yeah.
That's the brains are the coin of the realm these days. Mm-hmm. And so would they come to Texas as well?
Would who come to Texas?
Would the people who've got the brain wattage?
Well, I mean, we'd have to see what the stats are in that. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, most of the folks who are moving out there, I think, you don't see the corporate headquarters picking up and moving to Texas from California to Texas. I think most of the folks who are moving there are the folks further on down the food chain.
Well, pass this along to Californians that if they do move to Texas, we do not recognize medical marijuana cards.
Yet.
I don't think so. That's not ever going to happen.
Never say never.
Joe Garofoli is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's been writing about Governor Rick Perry's campaign to entice job generators to move to Texas. Perry has inspired a conversation comparing Texas and California. And some of the West Coasters are saying that when it comes to economic success in Texas, all that glitters isn't as golden as it is in the Golden State. But Chuck DeVore of the Conservative Texas Public Policy Foundation says the Lone Star State's economy shines bright.
Well, I think the most important thing to understand right off the bat is the two states are very similar in many ways, right? You have the biggest state and the second biggest state. They're very large geographically. They're very diverse in their populations. Where they differ is in their governance. The government in California is about 33% larger in both taxation and in the size of government as a percentage of the economy, and that leads to more regulations. And the lawsuit climate as well is less conducive in California. And so if you're a small business person, a medium-sized business, and can't afford a lot of lawyers and expensive tax attorneys, it's a lot harder to make ends meet in California than it is in Texas. And that's why you've seen Texas be the jobs engine for the United States for the last 10 years, whereas California has actually been about static in the number of jobs created, you know, the net number of jobs over the last 10 years.
Now, you know of what you speak because you worked in the California Assembly. You were a representative there, right?
Oh, yes, sir. For 6 years, I represented almost 500,000 people in Orange County in Southern California. I was vice chairman of the Revenue and Taxation Committee. I was on the Budget Committee. I was on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. So you might say, as a former Californian, I kind of know where the bodies are buried from the standpoint of the government and how it taxes and how it treats business.
So we have our Governor Rick Perry going to California this on Sunday and visiting some of the job generators there and trying to entice them to move to Texas. And, of course, the people in California aren't too crazy about that. And so we've kind of we have a war of words happening between people there and their governor and our governor. And they're making certain claims about what works and what doesn't work. So let's talk about some of these claims. So they're saying that Texas has created jobs, but these are low-wage positions and that Texas is actually tied with Mississippi for having the highest percentage of minimum wage jobs in the nation.
Well, you know, it's an interesting claim when you look at that, because what the Californians like to ignore is that cost of living matters. And California has the third highest cost of living in the country. Texas has the second lowest. And the difference between the two is 42%. And so here's how an interesting practical application of this, right? California has a higher minimum wage, at least on paper, than does Texas, $8 versus $7.25. But, you know, that money has to go to buy stuff, right? It has to go to buy food and clothing and rent or mortgage, whatever, right? And if you look at the cost of living in California, that $8 minimum wage only buys $6.06 worth of goods and services. In Texas, the lower minimum wage of $7.28 buys $8.04 of goods and services, meaning that if you have two workers each making minimum wage in the two states, the Texas worker is going to be making about $2 an hour more than their California counterpart. So you really have to look at cost of living before you start talking about wages.
Now, in Texas, 17.3% of the Texans are living in poverty in 2009. That's according to the U.S. Census, while only 15.3% of Californians lived in poverty that year. So that makes Texas look better, right?
Well, it makes California look better with the 2009 figure, right? Because it's 17.3% of Texans in poverty, 15.3% of Californians. But here's what's interesting, and I didn't know this until I researched it. The U.S. Census Bureau considers the same level of income across all 50 states as being what qualifies one for being under or over the poverty level. Now, Congress has criticized this for 20 years, and finally, U.S. Census, a week after the election in November, came out with something called the Supplemental Poverty Measure. It took into account two big things. They took into account cost of living, and they took into account government benefits. And with this new, far more comprehensive measure of poverty, the state that has the highest poverty level, it isn't even close, is California, with 23.5% of Californians considered impoverished, even more than Washington, D.C. Texas's rate actually dropped to 16.5%, which means from a proportional standpoint, there are about 42% more poor people in California as a percentage of the population than in Texas.
You hear this statistic a lot, that Texas has the most people without health insurance in the nation. Right now it's 26%. And California, a much better place, more health insurance, easier to get on Medicaid.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this statistic is that the difference in percentage between California and Texas is really very small from a statistical standpoint. But more importantly, you have to look at what they call coverage, because they're actually including Medicaid as coverage. In California, it's known as Medi-Cal. Now, out of the 37 million Californians, 9.2 million are in their Medi-Cal, or here in Texas, it'd be Medicaid system. Now, the problem with that is that California, to stretch their dollars so far to cover that many people, has the lowest reimbursements of doctors and hospitals of any Medicaid system in the country, and it's gotten to the point that less than half of California doctors will even see a Medicaid patient. And so the problem is, I kind of liken it to having a chest full of Confederate currency in 1866. It may look good, and you may say you have a chest full of currency, but who's going to take it? So similarly in California, if you're one of those 9.2 million people with Medicaid coverage, how do you see a doctor if less than half of them are now even taking Medicaid coverage? So, it's one thing to be covered. It's another thing to actually get care. Those two things are very different. And I would argue that people in Texas are actually being cared for more effectively than the equivalent poor population in California.
Chuck DeVore is a former California State Assemblyman. He is now a Vice President for Policy at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He expounds upon why his adopted homeland is booming while his former home state is floundering with the book, The Texas Model, Prosperity in the Lone Star State and Lessons for America. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. We do like hearing from you. Send those emails to texasmatters@tpr.org, or you can visit the website and comment right there. We're at tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs also posted on our website, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.